Now we're starting something new. Perek Tet, at long last. So in Perek Tet, we are going to meet a man by the name of Shaul. Right? He's introduced to us. If you take a look at the opening pasuk, take a look at the opening sentence, it's worth seeing. Vayi ish mi bin Yamin, also known as Binyamin. Right? We'll have to talk about that. Binyamin is the way we pronounce it. We pronounce it as one word, but it's written as though it were two words. Ushmo Kish, Ben Aviel, Ben Seror, Ben Becharat, Ben Afiach, Ben Ish Yemini, Gibor Chayil. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Anyone who's learned Ezra will be familiar with this style as well. And say for Ezra, Ezra's introduced to like 15 generations. Right? But he is Kish. This isn't Shaul. This is Kish, Shaul's father. Kish, son of Aviel, son of Tzor, son of Becharat, son of Afiach, going all the way back to Binyamin, Gibor Chayil. Gibor Chayil is an interesting word. Often it means what? Warrior. Although Chayil, generally speaking, means a person of substance.
Boaz,
Rus is described as Eshet Chayil. She's the only one in Tanakh to get that description. But yes, he's known as as Gibor Chayil as well. There are a few people in Tanakh who gave it a Gibor Chayil. She's the only one who's named as Eshet Chayil. But the term Chayil sometimes refers to a person of wealth. Sometimes it refers to a person of power. Sometimes it refers to a person of good conduct. And what it seems to me, the best English word I can come up with that sort of carries all of them is it's a person of substance, a person of significance, someone not to be messed with.
Mighty man of valor.
Mighty man of valor.
Might says power.
Yeah. To me, he's a strong person. Physically strong.
I mean, there is an element of strength potentially to it, but it isn't necessarily so. Yeah, sorry.
Is Gibor Chayil referring to this Kish, or is it referring to the last person on the list? Because I know what was
good.
Said
yes.
In the past.
Correct.
That if you name up to a certain person, there's a reason.
Correct. But in this case, it does seem to be about Kish, and that's the way the commentators will take it. But this person has a son, you'll find out in the next sentence, whose name is Shaul, and Shaul is going to be our first king. Granted that Yeshua has quasi-king status, Moshe has quasi-king status, but the first one to actually bear the title of HaMelech is going to be Shaul. And that already creates a problem. Just to give you a little bit of an outline of where we're going, though, because I realized I didn't do that in the beginning of the parak, and I usually try to do that. Yeah, we're now well into Sefer Shmuel. Like, we should feel good about that. It took us long enough. This was earned. But we have the miraculous birth of Shmuel to Chana in the opening Tuprakim with her prophetic song. We had Eli's sons abusing the Mishkan for their own enrichment, leading to the disastrous decision to take the Aron to war against the Plishtim. The Aron was lost. Chavni Pinchas died. The curse begins on the house of Eli. The Plishtim eventually returned the Aron miraculously, a way that demonstrates divine supervision. The Jews do tshuva during or after a 20-year period is not quite clear. Shmuel holds a national gathering. They reject their idols. The Plishtim attack. Hashem defends us. Things are good. And then the nation demands a king, right? Which we said may signal some kind of descent on their part, that they, as Shmuel ages, the nation is no longer as righteous as they were. They want a king who's going to originate justice, and that's where we get Shaul. Now, the next two prakim are a unit. They're one thing. So, it's going to start with an introduction to Shaul, but I want to tell you a little bit about where it's going, because that way you'll have a picture of the whole story. We're going to be introduced to Shaul. Shaul is going to be looking for donkeys together with a servant of the family, right? Which tells you they have servants and they have donkeys. So this is not an indigent family. Right. They're going to go looking for the donkeys. They're not going to find the donkeys. However, they're going to go to Shmuel to ask where the donkeys are, which tells you something interesting about the relationship that people had with prophets back in the day. Like, I think of a Navi as like the person who tells the king what to do. Right, whether he succeeds in guiding the king or not, I don't think of him as the lost and found. So that's
but
something that we have to.
Divinity can tell.
Yeah, but seriously, that's well beneath him. There you go. Add that to the list. So Shmuel and Shaul then meet. And then the next phase begins, because Hashem has told Shmuel about Shaul in advance, and has made certain arrangements which will demonstrate to Shaul the seriousness of what's going on, that, and then that when Shmuel says to him, you're going to become king, it isn't just a random thing, but actually he comes to believe that this is the truth. Then Shaul has quite the adventure, which was going to include Shaul himself becoming a Navi, becoming a prophet, and culminating in the end of Perek Yud with Shaul's coronation as king, sort of. And you'll see what I mean when we get there. But yeah.
I have a question. When, just in terms of the timeline, when the warnings come, and it feels a bit like Cassandra, you know, where the curse of foretelling the future, and,
yeah,
and no one's believing you, and what that's like. When they talk about the king that will be a traitor,
yeah,
are they talking about the king that they will have for their present king, for what the next one, or are they talking about for the future? And the reason I ask that is because there seems to be something incredibly childish and selfish. It's almost as if they want a king now, and they feel confident, perhaps, of the king that they'll have. But what about their children's king?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So is the warning for the king that they're, the man that's going to come before them, or is it?
Right. This is a good question. I think the warning is not specified. They're not told this is going to be the king you get, or this is going to be the king who comes in the future. I think accepting monarchy means accepting there will be future ones, and you're not going to have control of what's going to happen. As it happens, Shaul is not guilty of the things that are described here. Shaul doesn't steal from people. Shaul doesn't take them as slaves and so on. He's got other issues. There are problems that come up, which we're going to have to discuss. But that particular issue does not manifest in Shaul's time. It does not manifest really with David either, even though, again, there are issues that come up with David, which we're going to have to discuss as well. It's really post-David. You could argue it for Shlomo's time, and then after Shlomo for sure, that you start to see this play out in practice, and you're right, that generation is gone. Yeah, this is it's a good point. So, some of the questions we're going to need to look at here. Why is Shaul worthy? Why does Shaul get picked? When we look at the psukim, we're not going to understand. It said that he's a good-looking guy. He's young.
He's a good boy.
Ishtov. He's good. And he's tall. Right? Tall matters. Height matters.
So what's on the looks? Right?
Yeah. What is it that we're looking for here for a king? We're going to see a lot about divine manipulation of events and individuals, getting people to the places where he wants them to be for the plan to move forward. We're going to talk about how people perceived Nevi'im, the prophets, as well as the relationship between Hashem and the king. All of this is going to play into the next couple of chapters. But now I will ask my question, which I wanted to ask, which is, Shaul's from the wrong Shevet.
Why?
He's from Binyamin. Kings is supposed to be from Yehuda. Yehuda is royalty. What in the world are you doing? Take a look at source number 8. Yaakov says, as part of his brachot, part of the blessings that he gives to his children, Lo yasur shevet mihuda umchokek mibein raglav. Shevet and mechokek, you could look at Malbim for distinctions between the two, but it's not relevant for us. They're both terms for the scepter, essentially. So the shevet, the scepter, is never going to leave Yehuda. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh arrives, v'lo yikhas amim, and he will gather nations to him. Shiloh may be a reference to Mashiach, as we will see shortly, but the point is, monarchy is with Yehuda. It never leaves Yehuda. Not only that, you flip the page, take a look at source number 9, from Divrei Hayamim Aleph. This is when David wants to build a Beis HaMikdash, but he's not allowed to. There are different reasons given for why David can't build the Beis HaMikdash, but here we're getting one account of it, as recorded in Divrei Hayamim. Vayakam David HaMelech al Raglav. David stood up. Vayomer, and he said, Shma'uni Achai Ve'ami. right? Lend an ear, friends, Romans. No Romans in this picture. They listen, my brothers. Listen, my nation. I wanted to build a place of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of God. V'ladom raglei Elokeinu, the footstool for God. V'achinosi livnos, and I prepared to build. And indeed, it seems that, and the Midrashim talk about this, David created the plans, and David allocated wealth for it. It's just that Shlomo built it. V'alokim amarli, lo sivne bayis lishmi. Hashem said, nothing doing, you're not building it. Ki ish melchamos ata, v'damim shafachta. You are a person of war. You've spilled blood. V'yivchar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, bi mikol beis avi liyos lemelech al Yisrael le'olam. And Hashem, God of Israel, chose me from the entire house of my father to be king over Israel forever. And that's the key phrase. Ki b'Yehuda b'char l'nagid. He chose Yehuda to lead. Uba beis Yehuda beis avi. And in the house of Yehuda, he chose my father's family. Umivnei avi b'ratzal kol Yisrael. And we know this because when David is selected, he goes through all the kids and says, not that one, not that one, not that one, and that one. So I am the one. Umikol banai, and from all of my kids, kirabim banim nasan li Hashem. Hashem gave me lots of kids. His wife has nothing to do with it. Vayivchar b'Shlomo b'ni l'sheves hakisei malchus Hashem al Yisrael. Hashem chose my son Shlomo to be king, and he is building this temple, this Beis HaMikdash. But the emphasis for us, while it's an interesting passage for other reasons, but the emphasis for us is very clearly identifying Hashem chose Yehuda. Hashem chose the family of Yishai. Hashem chose David, and through him, Shlomo. So what gives? Why Binyamin? And one more source, in source number 10, this is generations later. This is Aviyah. Aviyah is in Avi at the time when the kingdom splits. After Shlomo's time, Shlomo's son Rehavam is the king, but he mismanages things, essentially. And in any case, Hashem is bringing this punishment upon the house of Shlomo because of mistakes associated with Shlomo. And they're going to lose a good chunk of the kingdom. And this fellow, Yerovam ben Nevat, leads the northern kingdom. The kingdom splits. And here you get source number 10. Vayakam Aviyah. This fellow, this prophet Aviyah, stands me'al la'artz marayim asher ba'ar Ephraim. He gets up on the mountain, Vayomer, and he said, Shma'uni Yeravam v'chol Yisrael, Yeravam and all Israel, listen up. Halo lachem ladas. You gotta know, ki Hashem Elokei Yisrael nasan ma'amlachol David al Yisrael le'olam. Hashem gave monarchy to David over Israel forever. For him, for his kids, bris melach, a covenant assault. The phrase covenant assault is fascinating, but not for right now. Linda?
Maybe putting Shaul as king gave them the opportunity. God was giving them an opportunity to change their minds. Because once it went into Judah and the house of David, they were going to be the king forever.
So that's good. So Hashem is choosing someone other than Yehuda in order to let them back out.
And maybe interesting. It's also Binyamin, like, who's not, like, who would have been Yosef or like Ephraim and Manasseh. It's not like, you know, Yehuda's technically, like, a rival to Yehuda, is what I'm saying. Like, Reuben, Shimon, and Levi weren't chosen because they did something bad, correct? And Yehuda's technically the oldest. But then by going to, let's say, Binyamin, who's maybe Raphael's son, is maybe not...
And the youngest.
Oh, I don't know the youngest, but maybe we'll start with David, but maybe by choosing this one from Binyamin, it's not a direct like conflict.
See, I would actually argue the opposite. When did we last meet Shevet Binyamin?
Well, they gave up.
Yeah. They fought a war against everybody else. It was everybody against Binyamin. Tens of thousands of people died.
So I should write.
Like, if I had to pick someone to provide the king, Binyamin is not my first choice.
Right, it'd be the top right.
Like, you're just asking for trouble.
But
yeah.
Well, maybe that would make it less desirable for the people. Like, that's who you're going to give us?
Well, that's actually the reaction.
Oh, really?
That's going to be their reaction. It's going to be him.
Maybe he was just the most worthy at the time, and they didn't...
And that could really be the answer, right. Hethi.
And isn't Shmuel in the vicinity of the Shevet Binyamin?
So Shmuel actually lives in Ramah, which Shiloh is in Binyamin. Is Shmuel, is Ramah in Binyamin or in Yehuda? I think you're right. I think it is in Binyamin. The, so that's an interesting point. So that's going to leave.
Area, so
area, he's around. But I think Hashem could have sent him wherever he wished.
True. But, you know, it's old and it's far to walk.
I don't think, somehow, if Hashem, you're going to see what Hashem does in order to get Shaul to show up at Shmuel's house. Hashem could have done that with whoever he wanted to get to show up. There's something about Shaul that's special. But the question still is, but what happened to Yehuda? So maybe the answer really is, as Linda said, we want somebody temporary. And Ramban is along those lines. But before I show you that, make things worse. Jump ahead, please. I gave you the reference in source number 11, so you can see it there. Chapter 13, sentence 13. It gets worse. Yes. This is after Shaul makes his first mistake.
Sentence which?
13.
Oh, wow.
What's 13? Chapter 10?
Mm-hmm. That happens. Okay, after Shaul makes his first mistake, this is before the war with Amalek. Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul niskalta. Shmuel says to Shaul, niskalta. Niskalta from the word sachal. No, not sechel, sachal. Sachal is a fool. You have been foolish. Right, I assume that's how your translations render it. Yeah. Lo shamarta es mitzvah Hashem Elokecha asher tzivach. You didn't listen to what God told you. Yes. Ki ata hechin Hashem es mamlachtecha Yisrael ad olam. Had you listened, Hashem would have set up your empire over Israel.
Forever.
Wrong tribe. What are you doing? How does this make any sense? I have Bereshit on the one hand, and I have Shmuel on the other hand. That's not a good match. So Ramban offers one answer. Abarbanel offers a different answer. Ramban in source number 12. He says monarchy was always, always intended to be for Yehuda. That's the way it was meant to be. He quotes you the pasuk Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda. Right, that's the pasuk that he's commenting on. That's where Yaakov said it. I'm just going to read out of the English in the interest of time, because I want to make sure to get through Ramban and Abarbanel if we can. He says, this doesn't mean it's never going to leave Yehuda. That's not what we're saying. Because, after all, the Tochacha already warns, Hashem warns the Jews of what's going to happen if they sin, and he says, God will lead you, your king whom you will appoint upon you, to a nation you have not known, you and your ancestors. So they and their king will be in exile. So you can't tell me the scepter never leaves Yehuda. It goes to Bavel. It goes to Rome. Right? They will no longer have kings and nobles. There's a long period without a king in Israel. So that's not what Yaakov means. There will be times when the scepter will leave Yehuda. Rather, it means the scepter will not depart from Yehuda to one of his brothers. The monarchy of Israel which will reign over them will be from him. And one of his brothers shall not reign over Israel until Shiloh comes and he gathers all of the nations to him, doing as he wishes to them. This is Mashiach. The scepter, that's by the way one of the hints in Chumash to Mashiach, is that that pasuk. The scepter hints at David, the first king who held the scepter of monarchy. Shiloh is his descendant who will gather nations to him. That's how he deals with generally. He hasn't addressed Shaul yet. He's just making a general point, which is, Yaakov gives monarchy to Yehuda. Monarchy may leave Israel, but it's never supposed to leave Yehuda. Well, then what do I do about Shaul? As far as Shaul, because the request for a king at that time was repellent before God, he did not wish to set upon them a king from the tribe which would hold the permanent monarchy. Oh, yeah. Not quite what Linda is saying. Linda is saying, it's your chance to back out. Right? What he's saying is not that. He says, God says, this is not being done the right way. I don't want to give you this to Yehuda right now. And he gave them a temporary monarchy. And this is hinted in Hosea, where the pasuk says, I placed upon you a king in my anger, and I removed him in my anger. He and his sons were killed. His monarchy was cut off. That's, in fact, the fate of Shaul. So, the next paragraph. And when Shmuel 1:13:13 says, you were foolish, you didn't guard the commands of Hashem your God, which he commanded you, God would have established your reign to Israel ad olam, which we took to mean forever. That means that had he not sinned, his children would have reigned in Israel, as the pasuk says, but not over all of them. In the Hebrew, it's El Yisrael. This is the meaning of to Israel. They would reign to Israel. Perhaps he would have, flip the page, reigned over his mother's tribes, Binyamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, right? The tribes of Rachel. For Yehuda and Ephraim are viewed as two nations in Israel. Or he would have been king beneath the king of Yehuda. That may be the answer. He could have been a sub-king. In my opinion, the kings from other tribes who reigned after David, because the northern kingdom is governed by people who are from Ephraim, people who are not from Yehuda, he says, not only Ephraim, but Ephraim, I think, no, maybe it is all Ephraim, I'm not sure. But he says, either way, the kings from other tribes who reigned after David violated the wishes of their ancestors, switching the lots of tribes, relying on the words of Achiah Shiloni, who anointed Yerubbaal and said, I will oppress the seed of David because of this, because of Solomon's mistakes, but not forever. And when the northern kingdom continued to coronate king after king from other tribes without returning to the monarchy of Yehuda, they violated the command of the elder, because Achiah Shiloni said, not forever. And they were punished, as Hosea said, they coronated, not me, it's not God. This was the reason for the punishment of the Hashmonaim who reigned in the Second Temple, and that's what makes Ramban most famous. This comment of Ramban is most famous because he then criticizes the Hashmonaim for taking the throne in the Second Temple. They were Levium. They weren't supposed to have that position. So Ramban's position is that what God was trying to do with Shaul was give us intentionally an inferior monarchy, because that was what we deserved at this point. And yes, he promised you could have it forever, but that didn't mean king monarchy over everything. Ralbag takes the same general approach with one variation. If you take a look at number 13, I did not write out translations for 13 and 14, but don't worry, we'll get through it. The ad olam, he says, when it says forever, yitachin sheyuvan ad zman rachav, that could mean a long time. Like Chana says about Shmuel, that he's going to be in the Mishkan via Shav Sham Ad Olam. He'll be there for a long time. Shairatan Bo, Kamo Nun Shana, like 50 years. V'chemash Kasabatar V'avado Le'olam, like by the Eved Ivri, right? The Jewish slave who decides to stay after his initial term is up. So he stays until Yovel, to the Jubilee year. But the Torah says Ad Olam, Le'olam. And he says, Lefiya Inyan, based on the context here, Haya Ratzon Bazeh Ma'amar Ki Hashem Yisvarach Hechin Mamlacha Shaul Ba'opin Shetizkayim Zman Rachav. What he's saying is, Hashem had arranged for Shaul to reign, such that he could have reigned for a long time. Lulei Zeh HaMeri Shemanami Menu Atov, if not for this rebellion, this disobedience, that prevented him from having it. V'lonis Kayim HaMlucha Lo Kiim Zman Muat, and that's why he only reigns for a short period of time. So that's one approach. Ramban, Ralbag say that Shaul is a temporary monarch because that's all the people deserve at this stage. Yeah, Effie.
So God set up Shaul to fail from the beginning? That doesn't make sense to me.
No, Shaul doesn't fail. Yes. He will still have a position of power. Either he will be king for a limited time, as Ralbag, or as Ramban, God will come to him at some point and say, thank you so much, you've done a great job, your children will continue to have power, but I'm going to be appointing somebody over you who's going to be king over the nation as a whole. That's the other way to look.
He's king over the nation.
Yeah, he was. That happens, you know, in organizational structures. So, but that's one take. Barbanel comes up with a radically different idea. Yes, it is. And this is, yes, you can see from the ellipses, I didn't bring you the whole thing. Yes, he is. That's the way he does things. But I'm going to tell you what he says. He says, V'ani achshov she'ena davar kedivrehem. He says, I don't think they're right. V'she'yakob b'birchosov l'nasana memshala v'amalchus el shevet Yehuda al echav. He says, I actually don't think that Yaakov, in that original bracha, the blessing gave to Yehuda, when he said, the scepter will not leave Yehuda, I don't think that he was saying that Yehuda is always going to be the king. That's not what the sentence meant. And he says, I'll prove it to you. And he brings a few claims, some of which I brought here. Ha'acha says, first of all, I'm going to translate it as I go along here, and I'm not going to read out the Hebrew, but you can see it there. He says, first of all, the word shevet, the shevet will never leave Yehuda, does not mean monarchy. Even though it means scepter, rod, it doesn't mean monarchy. It means any position of power.
What tribe, shevet?
That it also means that, but that's because they're led by this rod, I think. I think it's called that because this is the position of leadership of the tribe. That was the way I would take it. I think so. But he says the word Sheva includes any position of power. And had Yaakov meant only monarchy, he would have said, Lo yasur malchut mi beit Yehuda. He wouldn't have used the word Shevet. Shevet is a broader term. That's first of all. Second of all, he says, if Yaakov was really speaking about power always being from Yehuda, if that's really what he meant, then how is it that Moshe could be identified as a melech? Remember I said Moshe is a quasi-king? Moshe isn't from there. Yehoshua isn't from there. I skipped his third point and jumped to his fourth point, Hatana Revi'it. The fourth point that he raises is that if it were true that Yaakov had decreed that monarchy would always come from Yehuda, not from the other tribes, and we know that he's speaking with Hashem, by speaking through him, it's Ruach HaKodesh, then how could it be that when Hashem commands us to have a king, right, we learned this section from the Torah a few weeks ago when we discussed monarchy, Hashem tells you what to choose. He says, you shall place a king upon you whom Hashem will choose, mikarav achachav among your brethren, that's who you choose as a king. Don't take a foreigner. It didn't say anything about making sure that you choose someone from Yehuda. Hashem's given you criteria. Why didn't he give you Yehuda as one of your criteria if that really matters to him? Fifth, he says, fifth contention, he says, if it were true that Yehuda as a whole was given monarchy and power, then why is it that when Shlomo and his family sinned, Hashem took monarchy from him and gave it to Yerovam ben Nevat, who's from Ephraim? Give it to somebody else from Yehuda. Right? If Shlomo isn't worthy, so give it to another person from Yehuda. That doesn't fit. And he says, further, the pasuk says, we already read it, that that it says explicitly that had Shaul not sinned, his reign would have been ad olam, forever. Well, what happens now to the bracha of Yaakov for Yehuda? And he says, I know what Ramban says. He would have ruled over part of the tribes, or he would have ruled beneath Yehuda, beneath a king from Yehuda. He says, of these things, Hem Dvarm Shein Behem Mamash. He says, there's no substance to that, because the text says, God prepared your monarchy over Israel forever. He doesn't like abandoning the text. Granted that, if Abarbanel has an idea that needs to be squeezed into the psukim, we've seen him do that. But he doesn't believe that Ramban's idea is correct in the first place. So he says, look at the words. The words really don't seem to fit. He doesn't like it. He says, a king under another king? What does that even mean? So he says, I'll tell you what's going on. If you're following the Hebrew, it's the paragraph that begins, Hinei hitzba'er mi kol zeh. He says, what's clear from all of this is that with his blessings, Yaakov never meant to give monarchy to the tribe of Yehuda. That wasn't what he was doing. Rather, one of two things. Either he is saying that that monarchy, that power, will never leave Yehuda. Let me read it from the Hebrew to get it right. He says, "Im yomar shemisheva Yehuda lo yasur memshala b'shultanut al shivto pe'amim ve'akol ha'shvatim pe'amim." That power over Yehuda will never leave Yehuda, and sometimes it will even include power over others. And his point is that Yehuda is always going to be a leader. And I bolded some of his examples here. The Degalim. Right, when the Jews travel in the Midbar, right, the lead tribe in it is Yehuda. You have these four camps. Yehuda's camp is the lead camp. Yehuda leading them. Yehuda goes to war first. In the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, we're told Yehuda Ya'aleh. Yehuda is the one who goes first. And this is always going to play out this way, that they are going to be special. When they do a census later on, we find that the people of Yehuda are actually enumerated separately. He brings you an example of it there in the middle of the paragraph. Ayu b'nei Yisrael shlosh miyod elef, v'ish Yehuda shlosh miyod elef. They're counted separately. The idea is that Yehuda is always going to be a special tribe as leaders, but not that the king necessarily has to come from them. They're just going to have a unique identity. That's one approach. And then he takes a wildly different approach. He says, alternatively, Shevet has another meaning. It's still a rod, but it's a rod of punishment. what he's actually saying is, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, God will never stop punishing Yehuda when they commit wrongdoing. How do you like that one? because it's a vision of what's going to happen in the future. When Yehuda is the home of the Beis HaMikdash, and they go into exile. Whereas the northern kingdom goes into exile once at the hands of the Assyrians, Yehuda goes into exile twice at the hands of the Babylonians, and then again at the hands of the Romans. Right? There's a kina that said on the night of Tisha B'Av, right? The Shomron and versus Yerushalayim, right? The exile that they go through is a double exile. It's a double punishment, and that is what he is predicting. He is going to have to suffer in the future for the mistakes that he makes. Yehuda is going to suffer for it. So, the way he reads this is, Yehuda was not chosen by Yaakov. It didn't have to be. That the monarchy would come from Yehuda. However, and this is the big however, what does change is that that once David is selected, David finds favor in Hashem's eyes, and Hashem says to David, "Your descendants will always be kings." That we find that Barbanel brings it in at the end, that the monarchy is going to go to David and it will remain with David, and that explains the psukim that we saw in Divrei Hayamim, where David says, Hashem chose Yehuda and Hashem chose my father's family and he chose me, because once David is selected, Hashem is on his side, as the pasuk says, Hashem imo, God is with him, and from then on, David doesn't lose the throne.
But what you said, you remember Nevat was...
And that's the northern kingdom. They tear away the northern kingdom. That's a temporary thing. I have two more notes to make, and then we're going to stop here, because there's two... I got to go. But number one, this is going to be a theme throughout the reign of Shaul and David. The issue of Yehuda versus everybody else. And ultimately, we'll see the split. Although, interestingly, when they split, Binyamin, Shaul's tribe, remains with Yehuda. Those are the two tribes. That's number one. The other is, I feel like there has to be some kind of philosophical debate going on here between Ramban and Abarbanel about this. I don't think it's just about how you explain the meaning of the words. And I'm struggling to figure out what the framework is for it. That can be homework. You can think about it and come next week, God willing, to discuss it further. Thank you very much.